Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 233, NLP Modeling and Corporate Training with Tom Carroll.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast with your host, Dr. Dave. Coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area, Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Okay, so the power of really hearing the truth, what's really going on for somebody, and being willing to stay with that and be in that. For me, I think what happens there is that it just helps to amplify trust, and it creates a sacred space. And when you're modeling somebody, even in the work sense, if I'm in a work setting, when somebody starts talking about what they're good at, first of all, that generally clusters around what they're passionate about. So they're good at it. They also happen to be passionate about it. And it usually connects them very deeply to their identity, you know, who they are as a person. And I think when we witness that, if we can be in the right state of mind, right in the right frame of mind, you can be in the presence of hearing somebody talk about their work, talking about what they care about, and that can be a transformative experience.
That was the voice of my guest, Tom Carroll, speaking about his work as a corporate coach and trainer. Tom Carroll has been facilitating and conducting corporate training for the past 20 years. After earning a BA in psychology from the University of Oregon, he began his training/facilitating career as a community affairs officer for a nonprofit food bank food co-op program in the late 80s. There, he was a member of a business process improvement team and learned the standard total quality management tool set and the Imagineering facilitation style taught at Disney University. Tom later applied his business process and quality design skills as a management analyst in the insurance industry. In 1993, Tom began studying neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, at the Institute of NLP with Dr. Jonathan Rice and Andrea Rice. Tom went on to earn practitioner, master practitioner, modeling, and trainer certifications in NLP. He has since been using this valuable communication skill set to train, coach, facilitate, and consult. In addition to the NLP focus, Tom has certifications and or training in life/business coaching, instructional design, team skills, and business process improvement, quality, and project management. For nearly 10 years, Tom worked as a performance consultant and training manager for Symantec, an Austin-based semiconductor manufacturing industry consortium. There, he designed facilitations, facilitated groups, trained people to facilitate, and used his skills to redesign and improve training and development processes to gain ISO management certification for one of Symantec's subsidiaries. Tom has used behavioral modeling and interviewing skills to model highly skilled individuals across a wide variety of professions and industries. He has used this knowledge to help professional communities of practice develop and to create instructional materials and job aids to improve work performance. In 2008, Tom started Evolutionary Learning in Austin, Texas. He has been using his coaching skills and behavioral modeling of experts and rapid design of instruction and multimedia to help organizations from various industries learn more from their most talented people. Now, here's the interview. Tom Carroll, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, thank you, David. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's an honor and pleasure for me, too. I know you've been a long-time enthusiastic listener of Shrink Wrap Radio. And then the thing that really brought you to my attention, actually, was your tweets on Twitter. I don't often have time to look at Twitter, and I think I made the mistake of subscribing to way too many people on Twitter. So it's kind of becomes overwhelming, but I've always found myself interested in your tweets because you always refer your followers to really great content.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, you call yourself Tom the Learning Guy, and it's really true because what you do is, in my experience, you point me and your other followers to really great learning opportunities and learning content. So you really have shown me, you know, the way that Twitter should be used.
Oh, well, again, thank you very much. And it's what's so thrilling for me out there, and what I try to do with Twitter anyway, is extend my own personal learning and share, you know, resources that are really valuable, that I've found valuable to me in my learning.
Yes, exactly. And I think we've had some email exchanges prior to setting up this interview along the way, and those added further intrigue about who you are and what you're up to. And at some point, I realize you should be a guest on the show. And there are two broad areas that I see us covering in our interview today. First, your work as a corporate trainer and coach and educator, I guess, is part of that. And secondly, the ways in which you say Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel have helped you in that work. Does that sound like a plan?
Oh, that is fair. And I'm really excited to talk about it.
Okay, great. Well, you bill yourself to some degree as an NLP guy, and I have to confess my enthusiasm dipped a bit when I saw that you were involved with NLP, and I'll probably alienate some listeners as I say this. I guess I'm just not totally persuaded by the rather extravagant claims of NLP as a therapeutic approach. On the other hand, the NLP idea of modeling excellence does make sense to me, and I'm not sure that even requires the NLP tag. It just seems to kind of make sense on, you know, on the face of it.
Yeah, I think that's really accurate, and I have some of the same concerns and reservations as you do. And I think we've talked back and forth about this before, but one of the, I think, blessings in my life is that I've had a great upbringing. I had, you know, solid parents and good people in my life. So no one has ever been out to really hurt me. And a lot of this kind of human potential movement kind of stuff and folk psychology, pop psychology, that's not really grounded in experimental science or empirical science can be dangerous, especially in the hands of practitioners or people who have an intent to be greater or above the people that they're working with, or who in some way want to exercise the power over those people. And I've just been really fortunate, again, not only with family and upbringing, but also my experiences with NLP. I learned NLP from a fellow called Dr. Jonathan Rice, who is a clinical psychologist from California as well. And he worked early on with John Grinder and Richard Bandler, the founders of NLP, and he was he's very conscious and very careful to not use that kind of the set of psychological tools that is NLP to harm people. So again, I've been fortunate, and I know there are others who may have the experience where they may have been harmed by that set of tools, the way they're taught. In terms of what the value is about NLP, for me, there are really two things, I think, that are primary. The first is that John Grinder was a linguist, and so he brought a lot of tools from linguistics over to NLP, and those were really valuable for describing really specifically in sensory-based terms what somebody is experiencing out in the world. So really valuable set of tools. And then the second understanding, realization, or value I get from NLP is being able to observe things out in the world more carefully than I would have otherwise.
Yes.
And to have kind of a systems or a process orientation to the world out there.
Yeah, the systems orientation really makes sense. They were, I'm blocking on the name now, they, Grinder and Bandler were good friends with one of the main systems guys. You know who I'm thinking of?
Perhaps could it be Gregory Bateson?
Exactly, yes, married to Margaret Mead.
Yes, yes.
And Bateson brought in that whole systems viewpoint, which I think they took on. Now, in case anyone doesn't know what we're talking about, NLP stands for Neuro-Linguistic Programming. It was developed back in the early 70s by Richard Bandler and John Grinder, as you just mentioned. And as you mentioned, John Grinder was a linguist. Richard Bandler was a computer programmer, and therefore the neuro-linguistic programming title. And I think part of the reason why I was resonating to the modeling idea was a presentation that I heard at a market research conference. As you and probably many of my listeners know, I also have a hat of a market researcher. And at one of our annual conferences, I heard a woman from the UK present from a kind of an NLP perspective that they had done some studies modeling focus group facilitators, trying to figure out, okay, who's the best at doing this and what can we learn from them? So, and that approach made a lot of sense to me. And this woman was not flaky in any way, nor are you. So let's talk about modeling. And I know that one of the things that you do is modeling exemplars. So tell us what that means and kind of where it fits into your work.
Okay. Well, the notion of modeling comes from, again, it's been around a long time, but Albert Bandura from, the psychological world was one of the early, proponents of modeling and talking about modeling and social learning. That's how we learn. It's an easy way for us to learn.
And let me just slip in. I've been trying to get him on as a guest for about 2 years now. And he has not turned me down. He's in his 90s, I think, at this point. He's not turned me down. He's at Stanford, an emeritus professor like myself. If I aggrandize myself to put myself in the same status, but he keeps saying he's busy, and so he kind of puts it off into the future. So
isn't that wonderful, though? I mean, he's booked like George Burns was booked. Up to his 100th year at the Palladium, he had a gig.
Right. So I interrupted you. We were talking about modeling, and you were kind of in the flow.
Okay. Yeah. Just talking about sort of the background of what it is and how I use it at work is what it is actually. I could cover that. It's a way of watching somebody do what they do, listening to somebody do what they do, and then developing a description of that. And a description that is useful in learning or teaching that material or teaching that content so that somebody could possibly replicate that ability. Okay, so I say possibly replicate that ability. There's a lot that goes into doing that. Now, my background, I got into this world of the corporate America and training and development through actually having experiences where I got to see people who are exceptionally good at what they did and use the NLP background to kind of describe that in a way that was useful. And what I realized that I was doing was really that's the training and development part of the world is developing useful, teachable descriptions of how somebody gets to be excellent. And it turns out that in organizations, when I had various positions or jobs, that seems like where I sort of ended up. I sort of ended up in the training department because that was what my gift and skill set was all about. Was about watching people or replicating people's excellence, people who are really good, describing that and then sharing it with other people.
Yeah, and you know, you almost touched upon something that's kind of a question in my mind. As closely as you observe another person and you're able to sort of describe very accurately and maybe microscopically their skills and what it is they seem to be doing. This is really how NLP got developed, I guess, as Bandler and Grinder studied a couple of very well-known charismatic therapists, Milton Erickson on the one hand and Virginia Satir on the other. So the question that comes to mind, though, you know, I'm not sure there's been another Milton Erickson or another Virginia Satir. Mm-hmm. And so the question in my mind is, I'm just wondering if there's something that's ineffable that comes out of the personality of the person who has this excellence in their performance.
Boy, that's interesting that you say that. Excuse me. I think when you say there hasn't been another one, you're right. There hasn't been another one, but there are some people who are really, really exceptionally gifted in the therapeutic world, for example. So I think of, and David, I don't know. Do you know Stephen Gilligan?
Yes. I don't know him personally, but I know his work. One of my listeners shared with me one of his videos, and I'd like to get him on as a guest as well.
Well, he is an exceptionally gifted therapist, and he comes from that Ericksonian tradition. Mm-hmm. And so I've taken some classes with actually only one class with Stephen Gilligan, but he's written a wonderful book and describes something really important in his work. But so I would challenge that. And
okay.
The challenge is that there are people who are really gifted and that have the same kinds of gifts, but maybe they're just not famous or known. And in fact, that's the one thing I think
I'm not saying that there aren't other gifted people. The question I'm asking is, do they get that way through the process of having studied the model, so to speak?
I'm not sure. Most of them probably learn from other people. And if you look at let's talk from a psychological perspective. Let's look at the work of Howard Gardner. And your readers may be familiar with a book called Creating Minds. And in that book, what he talked about was what it takes to be really exceptional, you know, to be really gifted.
Yes.
And basically upshot in the way I understand it anyway, is it takes a lot of very concerted effort and practice, a specific kind of practice, and a lot of it, you know, 10,000 hours plus.
Yes.
Of practice. And, you know, so I think that what happens is there are lots of people out there, and there are many, many people who are practicing really sort of intensely and very carefully. And so I think they're made not only through modeling other people, but they're also made through having experiences, reflecting on those experiences and learning from, through the experience or from the experience. So I think it's happening all around us. It's happening all the time. And, for people who are really interested in that topic, there's another book, too, that's out that's new by a guy called Jeff Colvin. And the book is called Talent is Overrated. And I think the argument that book makes is very much like the Howard Gardner book, that it's a lot of practice that does it. And there's some great examples in that book. But what the interesting finding is there is he's saying that the rate of genius and acceleration of talent is increasing all the time. So what was 10,000 hours, at least in the world of chess, for example, mm-hmm. So they talked to some, modern grandmaster chess players, and what they're finding out is those chess players are becoming very, very talented in sort of at that genius level much faster. So that 10 years is compressed to, like, I think it's 5 years. Might want to check on the fact there. And one of the, I think one of the arguments made in the book is that that's probably due to the way we do instruction and the way we do practice. So we have you know, computer-based models that give us really crisp feedback about our performance and allow us to compress our experience by playing all sorts of games, all sorts of different variations of chess games, many more than we could have experienced before we had that kind of training in one, you know, condensed set of time frame. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, it does. And I think I ran across that 10,000 hours of practice idea in Malcolm Gladwell somewhere.
Yes.
Yeah, I've really, really like his work. I'll probably never get him on as a guest, but I really would like to. Let's ground this more in your work. I have the benefit of having been able to see a video presentation that you prepared for me generously and that you refer to as the Vain Whisperer. And and I don't think I would have understood what it is that you do quite so well had I not seen that. And I wish that our listeners could see it. And in fact, I will put a link to it in the show notes. So I would encourage any curious listeners, any listeners who, particularly who work in the corporate realm, who are interested in issues of learning and training in corporations or any educators actually, to be sure to go to the website and to look for that link. Take us through this sort of experience / case study with the Vain Whisperer.
Okay. So my wife was had a series of health challenges over the past couple years, but really strongly over the last year, where she had a series of operations and lots of problems with keeping her body hydrated, and she was having to go into the hospital a lot. And so what would happen is, you know, we'd get our five children all tucked away, and I'd go race my wife to the hospital, and we spent a lot of time there. Well, when we first got to the hospital, what happened to Susan was the nurses were giving her peripheral IVs, and the IVs were not holding, so they were blowing, and the nurses were missing. And I witnessed this.
They were missing the vein?
They were missing the vein, mm-hmm. or damaging the vein. Oh, and wow. And the problem with that is the nurses work distally, so away from the heart, and then they go up, and you only have so many chances, and you can use up your veins, and then you have to go to the central line, and it's more invasive. And it's also a lot less convenient and more expensive to the patient and all of that. So there are some problems with that. It's important to get it right if it's possible. Now, I didn't have a lot of experience with that. Maybe like most of your listeners, you know, I've had blood drawn and I've had a couple IVs and they weren't pleasant, but it wasn't terrible or anything. But what I noticed is that the nurses were missing, and my wife was really hurting. I mean, she was really hurting. And what was even sadder about this thing was the nurses were hurting too. They didn't want to harm my wife. And what I could tell was, and after watching them, that this seemed to be a skill problem. Like they literally weren't able to get this right. There's a fellow called Robert Mager who's kind of famous in the world of instructional design and human performance, and he calls that the gun to the head test. And the gun to the head test is if somebody put a gun to your head and ask you to perform something, if you can perform it, it is not a skill problem. But if you can't perform it, it is a skill problem. Mm-hmm. So obviously they could not perform it. They didn't know what to do and how to do it specifically. So then in comes this fellow, and his name is Roger Cleveland. And he has been a nurse for 40 years. He has a lot of experience with this, but his manner was very different and his way of working was very different. So he came calmly into the room. He addressed my wife. He said, Hi, Susan. My name is Roger Cleveland. I'm going to be your nurse today, and I'm going to start your IV for you. And I want you to know that I'm here for you, and I'm not going to hurt you. and he proceeded to work. Now, what was really interesting was I actually knew who Roger was before he came in, and it dawned on me who he was as he was working. And the reason for that was a very close colleague of mine had received an IV and was having problems like I just described, and they called Roger in, and this friend also happened to be a performance consultant, coach, and trainer, and he talked to me about the way Roger worked. And so it was his reputation was had preceded him, and I saw that and I said, wow, that is the same guy. So he gets done with this. Excuse me. He gets done with this, and Susan is feeling so much more relieved. The IV is in. It's comfortable. And then, of course, the bell rings for me, and the ring is, wow, this guy, obviously the difference, there are many differences here, and he works very differently. Why is that, and what is going on here? And so the first thing I, of course, want to know is, as seeing, and you know, I've seen a lot of really high performing people at work and worked with and coached people who are really high performing. And one of the things that high performers know is what their score is. So if I were to ask him, you know, how many of these do you get right, Roger? Because obviously there's a huge difference. I mean, we've gone 0 for 6 at that point. And he says, you know, over the past few years, the last 5,000 IVs I've done, my success rate is at 97%. So 97% of the time I hit it. And then I knew I had to ask him. I said, Roger, this is important. I see that you have a learnable skill. You have a set of tools that the other nurses don't have any experience with, it seems. You know, there's no skill there. May I model you? May I find out what it is that you do? What are the differences that make the difference in the way you do your work so we can share that with other nurses? And he said, you bet. I've been wanting to do this for many years. And so that is the genesis of the project.
That's really a fascinating story. I had no idea that giving an IV was such a challenging skill, but from your story, clearly it is. And as you pointed out, it was an aversive experience for your wife to have people come in and keep trying and keep trying and missing and inflicting pain. And it was aversive for those nurses who didn't have the skill as well, because none of us like to stand out as failures and none of us like to inflict pain. And clearly they were experiencing their own ineptness. And so, as you pointed out in your presentation that I saw, they would actually find ways, they would develop avoidant behaviors, pass it on to a different nurse, try to get out of it. And so I'm sure this is a metaphor for many other kinds of situations in the world of work.
Oh, it is. And I think, you know, that's really well said, what you just did, and that being a metaphor for many other experiences in work, because in my experience, it definitely is. And I think underlying this, what I'm hearing and what I was experiencing was that, and what I have experienced is that people want to do well. They want to succeed. They want to win. They want to do well at work. They don't want to fail. And so that's really kind of the heart of what I do with performance consulting and training and coaching, is help people to connect with their resources or whatever resources they need to reach their potential at work, or decide that maybe that's not for them. You know, if that position or that they don't have the set of skills, then maybe what we can do is find a place for them that works better and allows them to do what they're really here to do.
Now, in the case of this example that you've just given us, were you able to turn that into a paying project with the hospital? Were you able to get them to hire you to implement a training to raise the skill level of the other nurses?
No, not yet. And so that project was built on spec, like you'd build a spec home.
Okay.
And it's, for me, this is something that's really important, David. And what I want to do is be patient and get it right. And so, you know, however, this is a passion project really for me.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been able to do some surveying of the nurses at the hospital, and there's already a shift and a change in awareness. And we can tell by the kind of requests that Roger is getting. And the next level of this is to get further sponsorship. We've developed 5 skill modules, and the skills themselves have to do with, you know, the very fine details of getting the IV placed properly. And then also there's this sort of module that I shared with you, or this background piece that just sort of sets the stage and says, hey, here's something that's going on and something that needs to be addressed. And it is a skill issue. There are some other challenges too with a hospital setting. And one is the way that the learning is done in the hospital after you've had experience as a nurse, at least in this particular hospital. The way that education happens is they do continuing education to keep their units up. Like maybe a psychotherapist might do ethics or, you know, some other things like that. The same is true for nurses. However, when you really talk with the nurses, the first fact that strikes me is they don't get much training on peripheral IVs in school. Some of them I talked to maybe had a 1 hour to a half an hour unit on giving a peripheral IV, which is a highly invasive procedure. And then when they graduate from nursing school and they start working in the hospital, if they're lucky, they got mentored by somebody. If they were unlucky, the mentor had no experience with peripheral IVs, so they didn't get much more experience as they went along. And this was another one of those patterns that I've seen in work. When you have people who are exceptionally good performers and you have poor performers, one of the hallmarks or keys to exceptional performance is the willingness to watch somebody else work, to learn and ask questions and want to get better. What I saw at the hospital was that there wasn't any opportunity to do that, and that wasn't part of the culture.
And typically, the high performers by nature seem to be willing to be humble and subject themselves to learning from others. And those who are not high performers, the ones who need it most, right, tend to avoid that. Doesn't that tend to be true?
Oh, yeah. Again, I think that's really accurate in my experience. And I have one example that's a simple example, and that is people who are maintenance technicians. And I worked for a company that made semiconductor products, and there were some technicians in the fab. That's the factory where they manufacture these products, and the manufacturing technicians, were some of them were really exceptionally good troubleshooters, and some other ones were really not very, very skilled at that and wanted to become better. And the management wanted to know, you know, what's the difference here and what can we do to support these folks so that they can become, you know, everyone can become better. We can raise the tide for everybody. And one of the big learnings there was just what you said. First of all, it maps over really well to the hospital situation. But the big learning there was that whenever something like a tool had broken down, the people who were really skilled troubleshooters were quick to know, first of all, what the limits of their skills were, and then admit that they didn't know the answer and that they needed help. And they were very quick to admit that. Whereas those folks who were really struggling, oftentimes they would hide out and the problem would snowball. And as you pointed out too with the nurses, that seems to be the case because in the culture, they're not encouraged to share that information and sort of train and learn from each other to become better. So if you've been a nurse for 5 or 6 years, it's kind of expected that you would be good at that. Well, the same with these particular troubleshooters. Those who are not very talented or, you know, having difficulty with troubleshooting would hide out. And when somebody came in to repair the tool, finally, somebody who was very advanced, they would go out for a smoke break and turn the tool over to that person, not learning anything. Whereas the people who were, again, exceptionally good learners, they would take the time to, first of all, investigate the scene and interview people and make the handoff very clean to this expert coming in to repair the tool, you know, saying, here's what happened, giving them all the relevant facts. And then they would sit back as the expert was doing the work and ask to assist if they possibly could, and watch them and ask them questions about how they did what they did. And the principal piece of the principal finding here when all of this was done was that the very exceptional learners, very exceptional troubleshooters, were people who took that learning and then applied it back to their work, so that first of all, they tried to avoid that problem or that tool breaking down in the first place. So they tried to learn what was root cause and what could I do to avoid this next time. And they truly put their learning into action.
You know, coming out of an educational background as a university professor, I think I've observed the same kind of phenomenon where the very best teachers are the ones who are likely to sign up for teacher workshops and additional training. And,
yes.
And those who are not are more likely to avoid it. I've also seen the same thing in the world of market research and learning there. Now, one of the phrases that you use that intrigues me, and maybe it comes from the NLP background, I'm not sure. You talk about the difference that makes a difference. In the case of, was it Roger, the vein
yes.
whisperer?
Yeah, yes.
In the case of Roger, as you developed a model of his skill set, maybe you can just kind of quickly, you said there are five modules. Are there maybe five things that you found that were particularly distinctive that led to this difference that makes a difference in Roger?
Yes. Yeah. And first, if I may, I hope we have time. May I tell a small story about what I think, how will I say this? Intent makes a big difference.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Tell your story.
Okay. Intent makes a big difference. And this is not necessary. This isn't my tale, but it's a tale I learned from someone I respect very deeply. And his name is David Gordon. And he came up back from the NLP. He's from the NLP background. And he's the fellow that really taught me a lot about modeling. And we wanted to model the modeler. And so we sat him down after a series of workshops we had with him and said, David, what's most important to you when you model somebody? And he sort of leaned back in his chair and got a big broad smile, and he goes, well, let me tell you a story. And he said, when I was a child, about 6 years old, we had a tradition in our family that every summer we'd go on a vacation. And I knew it was time for summer and ready for that vacation when we got a brand new pair of sneakers, little pair of Keds for the summer. And one summer, we went on this traditional trip, and I got my brand new red pair of Keds, and we were on the way in a station wagon to the Grand Canyon. And on the way there, I was so excited. He said it was hot, and we were all, you know, are we almost there? Are we almost there yet? And he wanted to let his tennis shoes out for a run. And so he explained, they got down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. And he said, you know, we got out, and the first thing here, being a kid, the first thing I noticed is there are rocks in the middle of the river that are spaced just so that a little kid with a brand new pair of red Keds could fly from rock to rock. Mm-hmm. And he said, so I bolted from the car and ran down to the river and jumped from rock to rock. And he said it was just a sort of an entrancing experience where I'd go, you know, rock, rock, rock. And he felt the wind rushing past him, mm-hmm. and his hair flying. And he was really into the experience. He rounded the corner, and he suddenly was sort of knocked out of his trance by this very rushing sound. And he stopped and he looked up and he saw a waterfall, and with one of those kind that was just sort of spewing from a crack in the canyon wall. And he said, it was magnificent. He said, the rainbows were spewing off of this thing. And he said, that is what it's like when I sit down to model a person.
Wow.
He said, I want to tell you, this is what has drawn me to this work, and it's what's so very special about this work. And oftentimes, it's at the heart or at the core of excellence in all of the fields and all of the positions and all the people that I've seen, is they have this kind of reverence, this kind of soulfulness that comes out of their work. And this is Roger. This describes Roger. When he encounters a patient, he's sitting down with the waterfall. They're a miracle. He sits down and beholds them, and he gets into communion with you, a very deep kind of relationship. That's a healing relationship that he has with you, mm-hmm. kind of like, you know, maybe what Carl Rogers must have been like.
Yes.
You know, and you sat down with him and his unconditional positive regard for you. And he is that kind of a person. So it starts with the right mindset and the right, with your heart being in the right place, the right intent. And that sets the scene for all that follows, and what his primary goal is in doing this work. And by the way, I've been talking to Roger for 5 months, so he'll come pretty much weekly to my house on the way to work and spend an hour to 2 hours, and I'll either talk about or watch him do what he does. So we've had a lot of time together to kind of get to know each other. And this is primary with him, is he's the kind of person that has a healing presence. And so that's it. And then his goal is about healing. So everything he does is toward that end. And he sees himself as a facilitator of healing. And you mentioned earlier about humility. And we gave him, after we saw him work, we gave him the moniker, the name, the Vein Whisperer, just like the Horse Whisperer.
Yes.
You know, it's, he had a way, you know, you could tell this guy could work, and he was taken with that, and he thought it was cute, and so he put it on his toolbox. He has a box to hold his tools. And then one day he came to my house, and he had his box, and it didn't have the Vein Whisperer on it. And I say, "What's up?" And he said, "You know what?" He goes, "I was checking in with myself about this," and he said, "I don't think that this is messing with my sense of humility." And I said, "Oh, tell me about, you know, is that important for what you do?" And he said, "Oh, you bet it's important." He said, "What happens is when I start getting too into my own ego and too into my own self, I'm not paying attention to my intention to heal and facilitate the healing of the patient." And so he said, "It's important that I'm in the right frame of mind for that. And that frame of mind is about humility." Now, that translates across a lot of industries. So for those listeners who are really into leadership and business, and you want to see how this kind of very deep intention translates to the business world, take a look at Jim Collins' book called Good to Great. And this is what drives the kind of leader that Collins calls the level 5 leader. So they're people that are they're exceedingly humble, and they're in service to a greater cause, in service to the people that are working there. And they are available on a very deep personal level. So now, intent.
Go ahead. Intent and.
Okay, so there's having the right intent. The other is having a systems view of what you do. And so Roger has a very clear idea of the goals and the process steps, and he has worked out over many years how these things, how the component parts of the system interplay with various populations of patients. So he knows what could go wrong and how that all fits together. But he has a very clear idea of where he is and what his goal is if you stop him any place in the process. So he can tell you where he came from, and he can tell you where he's going. Now, I don't know, is that, you would probably relate that in a therapeutic, what a therapist might do. Is that, would you say that's accurate?
Sure.
A very skilled therapist knows, you know, they know what the questions are going to elicit, they hope, and they're directing.
Yeah. I don't want to go there, though.
Okay.
As you were talking about Roger and the waterfall experience and this sort of deep sense of presence and being with another person, it brings me back to that earlier question of whether or not people can be trained to be that way. It sounds so intrinsic to his nature, so intrinsic to the fellow that you told that story about, the modeler who you were modeling, Gordon, I guess it was.
Yes.
So intrinsic to their nature, it seems like those would be great selection criteria for choosing who does this kind of work and who doesn't if they don't have these criteria. But again, I'm wondering, can you really train people to have that kind of deep intrinsic motivation, sense of presence, etc.?
Yeah, and again, that is a good question for a psychologist. And from my perspective, I think it's key, and I don't believe you can train it. I don't believe people can. However, I do believe people can have significant experiences that ignite that, or they touch that in their lives. And you know, you had a guest on you have had a number of guests on your shows, and you know, some of these shows are important for me as a person doing this kind of work to hear and to listen to. And one of the guys that really touched me in that way was Dana Houck.
Yes.
Dana Houck talking about working with prisoners. And what he said is the sort of the condition, again, the way I understood him anyway, was for these prisoners to really open up was his insistence on them telling the truth. Okay, so the power of really hearing the truth, what's really going on for somebody, and being willing to stay with that and be in that. For me, I think what happens there is that it just helps to amplify trust, and it creates a sacred space. And when you're modeling somebody, even in the work sense, if I'm in a work setting, when somebody starts talking about what they're good at, first of all, that generally clusters around what they're passionate about. So they're good at it. They also happen to be passionate about it. And it usually connects them very deeply to their identity, you know, who they are as a person. And I think when we witness that, if we can be in the right state of mind, bright in the right frame of mind, like witnessing the waterfall as an example, you can be in the presence of hearing somebody talk about their work, talking about what they care about, and that can be a transformative experience. And I see it happen in a workplace.
Yes. Yes, I like that. Well, you know, going into this, I knew that we were going to not have enough time. There are so many more questions I'd like to ask you and places where we could probe. But of course, you've just sort of opened this other door that I was interested in, self-interest here. It may sound arrogant, but you've said that Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel have actually helped you in your work, and you just gave an example. Were there other examples that you wanted to touch upon?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a fellow that you worked with, you have worked with in the past. I think you lead workshops with him, experiential-type workshops, Ronald Alexander.
Yes.
Okay, you did a piece, I think it was a show called Leadership and Mindful Living.
Right.
Okay. That really struck a chord with me in a number of different ways. But, you know, I know he's gone to India quite a bit, and he's got that sort of mindset. But he's the kind of fellow that the mindful leader that he talks about, that really resonates with me. And it, in my experience with people, I've seen many examples of that in the corporate world. There are people that, again, they view their work, they're very connected and very mindful in the kind of work they do. And I think the point that I took away from what Dr. Alexander was talking about was that really good leaders care deeply about their people and nurturing and helping to create an environment where people can be the best that they can possibly be.
Yes. Yes.
And I see that as that's where we're going when we're talking about corporate development and corporate training, the sort of deeper end of that pool is what he was talking about there. And I, you know, I've had experiences. I had one, and again, here's another. Do you have time for another story?
Sure.
Okay, I'll try to make it very, very quickly. But once I was invited with a colleague of mine to model someone who was very good at creating presence with another person. Okay, so being in presence with somebody. And we were modeling for this other fellow, this client, who was writing a book on presence. And so we sit down and talk with this young man, and he was probably in his later 30s. And he was a Swiss doctor. And he was a fellow who had gone, he's part of a worldwide effort to standardize vaccines, and he would go into war-torn countries and work with children. And this author friend of ours was so impressed with this fellow's rock-solid, unshaking sense of presence that he wanted to find out, you know, what was that all about? You know, how did he come to develop that sense of presence? And so we had this marvelous session, and it turns out that he actually did his internship in India with a female doctor who worked with children, and these clinics that she was in were grossly understaffed and under-resourced, and he learned by modeling her, this woman, what truly present, loving professional behavior was all about, and how to maintain a state of presence in chaotic environments. Mm-hmm. So she would go from one child and be completely with that child, and then that child may even have died and just gone back and talked to the parents, and then had moved on to the other child. And in the meantime, she was able to pop out and be available to the interns to discuss the experience.
Yeah.
And so that's the kind, I mean, we had this wonderful conversation with this fellow, and his learning was about, again, it was a lot of it was about intent, and at the base of it is a kind of a lovingness for all people and the whole notion of unity, etc. But so anyway, I had this wonderful conversation, and that night I go to sleep, and I start dreaming, and I have a wonderful dream. And what I dreamt of was, do you remember that movie, To Kill a Mockingbird?
Oh, of course. The movie, yeah, so and the book.
Yeah. Yes. And the book. And so what the scene that came to me was that moment when the children had snuck out of Boo Radley's garden and they wandered into the woods and they were accosted by that killer. And then all of a sudden Boo Radley shows up and protects the children. And Boo Radley had been kind of a scary, mysterious character to the children. They were fascinated by him, but also terrified by him. But in that moment, it became obvious to me that Boo Radley was very misunderstood, but he was always present and loving for mm-hmm. these children. And so I woke up, and what happened was I got this message, and it was the weirdest, strangest thing. I got this, but I've also learned to kind of honor these things as well, you know? So I get this message that says, go buy the Dalai Lama's book, The Essence of the Heart Sutra. So I had no idea about this book. It must have been something we had talked about during that modeling session with that fellow. I went out and bought it, and what I experienced was an opening of my heart fully. For about a week, it was absolutely pegged open.
Wow.
And it was just, you know, remarkable. And I think this is one of those experiences we were talking about with intent and really kind of a Satori moment in a sense, you know, where I really got a sense of unity and understanding of how we relate to each other more deeply because of this fellow's loving recounting of his experience. So it had that kind of really profound effect on me. Now, I haven't been able to maintain that fully, but I think that's part of my, you know, growth and the excitement that I experience every day is getting back to that, kind of understanding more about what that's about and experiencing it more frequently.
Synchronistically, I was reading about that very phenomenon last night as I was reading a book for an upcoming guest, a Jungian author by the name of Monica Wickman, and she was writing about that very thing of moving the knowledge of the head down into the heart and the importance of that and how the heart can open up, and that's really the beginning of a kind of spiritual enlivenment. And so that story, Tom, is a great place for us to close. So I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio, and I hope you'll continue to find inspiration in Shrink Wrap Radio and wise counsel as I find inspiration in you.
Oh, thank you, David. And again, I appreciate you doing a wonderful service for all of us. So thanks for all the great work. We really appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Tom Carroll. He and I seem to have great rapport with one another and a mutual liking, so you may be hearing more from him here in the future. I think he was a little nervous in the beginning of the interview, just from his sheer excitement of being on the show. But I think you probably began to get more of a sense of him as we got further into the interview and his real passion started to come through. I'm recording this quite a bit before it will be posted. By the time you hear this, I should have a link in the show notes to the PowerPoint demo he created about the Vain Whisperer. It's really worth your taking time to get that link. I'd announce it now, but I don't have it yet. So you really will want to go to the show site and look for that link when you hear the show. I think Tom embodies the qualities of the exemplar models he sets out to model. You heard me rave about his tweets. You can subscribe to him on Twitter at twitter.com/TomLearningGuy. And his website is www.evolutionarylearning.com. Tom also let me know that he's a blues guitar player. I'm very fond of the blues and have long been a blues guitar wannabe. I suggested we try a collaboration on one of my all-time favorite blues songs, Key to the Highway. I came up with some lyrics, and Tom has come up with a one-verse version. I hope I can persuade him to do the longer version with all the verses, but he's a little self-conscious. Maybe you can go to his website and drop him an email with some encouragement. Here's Key to the Highway, except we're calling it Key to the Highway. Hello, everyone. It's another beautiful Northern California day, 73 degrees Fahrenheit here at 3 in the afternoon. I think spring has sprung, or it's certainly about to. Last podcast, I announced that I would be putting some CEU courses together based on collections of interviews. That's still going to happen, but it takes a lot of work, and I haven't had any time to move ahead on the first course, which will be on the topic of positive psychology. If you're a longtime listener, you'll be aware that I also wear another hat as a market research consultant. Due to the economy, my consulting work has been languishing. I don't know if it's spring or what, but for the past several weeks, I've been extremely busy. And I guess that's a good thing, but it's meant I've not been able to move forward on the CEU front. I still have work to do to get my presentation for that market research conference in Prague trimmed down as well. I'm happy to report that I've heard from three different listeners in Vienna, and I'm looking forward to meeting them. So Hugh, Reinhard, and Margaret, I look forward to meeting you all about 6 weeks from now. If you haven't done so already, you might want to hear my latest interview at wisecounselpodcast.com. It's with Dr. George Bonanno on bereavement. I was fascinated to learn that in some respects, Kubler-Ross got it wrong when it comes to the stages of grieving for the loss of a loved one. Check it out. Be sure to visit our Shrink Wrap Radio store, where you'll find not only t-shirts, but also some CDs that I've created for you. Have I mentioned lately that most of our shows have typed transcripts that you can download for free? Thanks to the volunteers who've made that happen, it provides incredible value, I think. Please contact me, though, if you'd be interested in being a volunteer transcriber, because I'm afraid our transcription activity has fallen off. You'll notice I'm not carrying any advertising these days, but we do have a Top Spots widget on our Shrink Wrap Radio website page where you can post a little ad for your products, services, website, or blog for a one-time $20 PayPal payment. And your ad will be up there for months and months if the past is any guide. Finally, let me remind you that this show is supported by your generous donations, both those that are one time and those that are continuing for 6 or 12 months. So thank you for your support.
Hi, this is Irish psychoanalyst Paul Moore, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Paul Moore, my Irish friend, who will be my guest on my next episode. Now let's check our mailbag. First, we hear from Dave, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I just finished listening for the second time to your episode with Robert Wagoner on lucid dreaming. I love psychology in general, but dreaming has always been near and dear to me since my vivid early childhood dreams. Just wanted to drop you a line and let you know how much I've enjoyed your show since I discovered it a couple of years ago. Many other podcasts have lost my interest over time, but yours never fails to keep me listening. I just saw the movie Avatar last weekend and was struck by how rich it is in Jungian archetypal imagery. I'd like to recommend it to you if you haven't already seen it. You might even get an idea or two for topics to discuss on your show. I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts about it, or maybe even a Jungian perspective. Anyway, I know you're a busy man, so I'll let you go. Take care and keep up the great work. Sincerely, Dave. Hey, Dave, I did see Avatar, and actually by now it's been a month or more ago, and I really loved it. I thought it should have been the big winner at the Oscars, even though I like The Hurt Locker. I think that Avatar was the better film, personally. And I'm really glad to hear that you're getting so much out of Shrink Wrap Radio, and hope you will continue to be a listener. And yes, maybe we will get a Jungian perspective on Avatar at some point. Next, we hear from Charles in Colorado Springs, who writes, Dr. Dave, I've learned so much from your podcast series that I decided to post a link on my blog, Bloodthirsty Warmonger. And that's at bloodthirstywarmonger.blogspot.com, if you're interested. He goes on to say, which deals with politics, usually of the conservative variety, although we practice intellectual diversity. A closely related topic, toilet lore, current events, assorted trivia, and mental health issues. That's quite a combination. This combination of topics and passions makes it unique in the blogosphere. Yes, I would say so. Keep up the good work. Your efforts are enlightening minds and opening eyes in the most unlikely places, and I have burned CDs of your dulcet voice and excellent questions to distribute to friends. And that's signed Charles in Colorado Springs. And Charles, you can probably tell I'm not a conservative, but I'm really happy to hear that I'm able to speak to a broad audience. That includes you, and proud to have you as an independent-minded listener. So thanks. Moving right along, next we hear from Bree in Perth, Western Australia, and she writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I want to thank you for a very, she put lots of R's in it, for a very inspiring podcast. I've just finished my psychology degree, and I can honestly say that I haven't attended one lecture as interesting as many of the interviews on your show or as informative. Thank you. I learn like a sponge from your guests, both personally and professionally. I often upload the interviews on my iPod and walk on the beach to absorb them. I think I may have gone through all the uploadable segments via iTunes. Is there a way of uploading your archives onto an iPod? When I try to drag them across to my iTunes library, it says that the web path is incorrect or something similar. Anyway, Dr. Dave, you've created a brilliant forum for learning and inspiration. Your warmth and honesty always shines through as an interviewer, prompting your guests to really open up and share their life stories. Cheers. And that's from Bree in Perth, Western Australia. And Bree, I do have 3 CDs in the store, in the Shrink Wrap Radio store, that contain the first 75 shows. And I think I have even more than 3 now. I'm not sure. So check the store, because you could easily download the MP3s from those CDs onto your MP3 player. Finally, here's one more from Yana, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. She writes, "Dear David, I started listening to your podcast several months ago, and I wanted to let you know how much I enjoy it. I really love it. I listen to a number of podcasts, and I find yours truly gripping. I love the way your interviewees reveal themselves in conversation with you, and these are, of course, the best parts of each podcast. And good news for your guests, I often buy their books. I've been in internet marketing for a long time, and I enjoy it, but I do it for a company in an industry I'm not interested in. At a late stage in my career, I'm developing an idea for a website that will help people find practitioners who are involved in mind-body medicine, sometimes described as integrative or complementary medicine. It would also be a hub for information about these options for healing and a place where practitioners could have their own website or link to their website. I have always been interested in psychology and the mind-body connection. I edited 2 anthologies on these subjects about 10 years ago, and after being encouraged by the current thinking on doing what you love, I'm hoping to combine my experience with online marketing with my passion for these 2 subjects. I'm just sharing this because I feel like I almost know you, and if you have any thoughts on this idea, I would appreciate hearing them. I didn't start out with the idea of talking about me. My main thought in writing to you is to let you know how much your podcast is appreciated best, and that's from Yana. Yana, that sounds like a wonderful enterprise. Years and years ago, I taught a class called Psychology and the Body, because I thought there was a coming together there that was very important of mind-body practices, and I was looking for a way to get that message out and in a kind of integrative way. And now I'm able to do that through the podcast. So keep us posted as this website that you're planning develops. I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on our site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I am ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my guest, Tom Carroll, for sharing his experience and insights into the uses of NLP modeling in corporate training and consulting. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Irish psychoanalyst Paul Moore. I met Paul about 5 years ago when he was still a student studying psychoanalysis at Trinity College in Dublin, and Paul attended the weekend workshop that I led there in Ireland that year, and we became fast friends. So I hope you'll join us. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.